Episode 22 of By Our Own Hands. The following day, I learned that Reverend Matarin and Father Kerr had written a letter to Mr. Adair begging him to reconsider and spare his tenants. Mr. Adair ignored the letter. Reverend Matarin responded to Mr. Adair's indifference by sending the letter to a newspaper. It was printed only a few days before the evictions were to take place. Mr. Adair was furious. He considered this act to be a personal betrayal. He threatened to thrash Father Kerr. He told Reverend Matarin that he was disappointed with him and that he would remove himself from the Reverend's residence as soon as he was able to. The day after the letter was publicly printed, another newspaper commented. This newspaper dismissed Reverend Matarin's plea and even questioned whether or not Reverend Matarin could have written a letter stating, "No man educated in Trinity College could have had anything to do with the composition of such a document." The article was as insulting as it was indifferent. My prayer was not answered, and the dreaded day arrived. I woke early on the day that the evictions were to begin. I was surprised to find Mrs. O'Donnell in the kitchen because the household servants had been given the day. Each of their families had been allowed to stay on, and their relations had been added to the list of those to be spared. The list of the three spared families had grown to 9. Mrs. O'Donnell had warned me to keep clear of the evictions. I had agreed to do so, but Sean had convinced me that we should ignore Mrs. O'Donnell's warnings. I did not want to defy her. On that morning, I sat in the kitchen and tried to think of a way to convince Mrs. O'Donnell that Sean was correct. "Mrs. O'Donnell, I need to ask you something," I began. She sighed. "I told you that you are not to go near the sheriff and his men when they are carrying out their terrible task," she said. "I know, but Sean thinks that we should. He said that some have removed themselves, but others have not. He wants to know what happens to those that have not yet left their cottages," I said. "Neither of you can help them, and there could be violence," she said. "Sean said that we can help them," I protested. "How?" she asked, crossing her arms. I was quiet for a moment. I wasn't sure how we were going to help anyone. I had simply put my trust in Sean. "Sean said that we could go with Francis Bradley. He is going to try and help. His father has refused to leave his cottage," I said. Only one of the cottages spared did not belong to a servant or a close relation of a servant. That was Francis Bradley's cottage. He had a reputation as a skilled laborer and was said to possess a remarkable ability with animals. Many believed that Mr. Adair hoped to employ Francis Bradley since so many of his Scotsmen had departed like rats fleeing a sinking ship. I was not surprised that Francis Bradley had been spared, but I was surprised that this same consideration had not been extended to his father's household. Francis had recently befriended Sean. He was much older than Sean, but he had taken a liking to him. Francis was very quiet and kept to himself. Sean and I had come upon him one day while we were walking Sally. He had taken his sheep to graze in an area that was not watched as closely as the rest of Mr. Adair's lands. When he first noticed us, he had glared at us. Sean and I soon made it clear that he had nothing to fear. We told him that we had learned that Mr. Murray's acres were not watched since the Murray cottage had been abandoned. Francis was soon taking his sheep to graze on those acres unbeknownst to all except for Sean and me. Francis Bradley, Mrs. O'Donnell said. Yes, he is Sean's friend, I said. Your young man will go with Francis Bradley. You will go with me, she said. I was surprised. Perhaps we can be of help, she continued. She reached out and cupped my chin in her hand. If I tell you that we must leave, you will not argue with me, she said. I looked directly into her eyes. I didn't answer. She removed her hand from my chin. I nodded in agreement. We both turned at the sound of a noise coming down the hall. It was the sound of footsteps and a door banging shut in the hallway. Sean entered the kitchen with Sally. They are here, he said. Where is your friend? Mrs. O'Donnell asked. He is outside near the stables, Sean said. I will take Aoife and we will follow the two of you, she said. I could see that Sean was surprised too, but he did not say a word. Mrs. O'Donnell took Sally's leash from Sean. Take one of the horses with you in case anyone is injured and needs assistance. We will have a difficult time carrying anyone that needs a doctor, she added. I inhaled deeply. The possibility had not even occurred to me that someone might be injured by the sheriff and his men. Mrs. O'Donnell looked at me and gave me a faint smile. She handed Sally's leash to me. Sally nuzzled her nose against me. We heard voices shouting from outside the house. There are at least 100 men, maybe more, Sean said. Mrs. O'Donnell and I exchanged looks. Get the horse ready. We will follow the sheriff's men once they leave, she said. Within an hour, we were following the men as they moved down the main road that led from the house in the direction of the cottages nearest the house. Mrs. O'Donnell and I walked with Sally several feet behind Sean and Francis. They walked ahead of us at a steady pace with Pegasus. They were at least 50 yards from the sheriff's men, and we were at least half that distance from them. It did not take us long to come to the first cottage. It was occupied by a widow, Mrs. Hannah McHoward. She was at least 60 and lived in her cottage with her son and 6 daughters. As the sheriff and his men approached, they fell silent. Before they reached Mrs. McHoward's cottage, she began to keen. Her cries carried through the glen like a death knell. Her cries told for all of us whether we had been spared or not. The sheriff was the first to reach the cottage. He opened the door to the cottage. Soon, Mrs. McHoward emerged with her children. They were sobbing and moaning. The sheriff motioned towards several of his men who stood outside the cottage. They each carried crowbars. They entered the cottage and the sound of hammering, cracking, and splitting filled the air. These terrible sounds were joined by the keening of Mrs. McHoward and her daughters who had thrown themselves onto the ground. They pounded the ground with their fist and gave vent to their despair. I watched as the sheriff's men emerged from the cottage one by one to finish the destruction and leveling of the cottage. They were joined by more men who carried sledgehammers. The prying of the crowbars and the pounding of the sledgehammers soon leveled the cottage. The frantic sobs and mournful keens of Mrs. McHoward and her daughters gave way to moaning. The sheriff looked about and then looked at the widow. He diverted his eyes and motioned for his men to move on. We followed them to the next cottage. It was the cottage of John Doherty. He emerged from the cottage with his wife and son. She began to wail. She threw herself on the ground and pounded the ground with her fist. The sheriff's men began to level the cottage. John Doherty stood by and watched with his young son. Neither made a sound. When the door to the cottage was ripped apart, he walked to the ruins and retrieved a small piece of wood, which he held in his hand. Their small cottage was destroyed in less than 20 minutes. The sheriff's men continued on to the cottage of Michael Bradley. He was Francis Bradley's father. Michael Bradley emerged from the cottage with his wife and four children, all considerably younger than Francis. Francis handed the reins of the horse to Sean and ran to his family. They were all silent. Mrs. Bradley did not keen. Michael Bradley wiped away tears, but he too did not make a sound. Francis reached his family just as the sheriff's men began to level the cottage. It was a large and well-built cottage. More than a dozen men attacked it with their sledgehammers. Francis stood next to his father and placed his hand on his father's shoulder. Mrs. O'Donnell and I continued walking, and we reached Sean. He reached towards me and wiped a tear off of my cheek. I hadn't realized I had been crying. We all stood together. We were as silent as Francis and his family. The only sound was the splitting and cracking of their hearth and home. We watched as it slowly fell in on itself. It was soon a ruinous heap. Francis returned to us with his brothers and sisters. They did not speak to any of us. He took Pegasus's reins, and we all continued following the sheriff's men. I knew that his parents and siblings would move into Francis's small cottage that he shared with his wife and children. I wanted to reach out to him and hold his hand, but I did not. We walked on to the next cottage. It was small and empty. It was the cottage of William Armstrong and his three small children. He was a widower. He had been one of the first to leave the Glen on hearing of the evictions. His cottage was already empty of life. The sheriff and his men quickly leveled it. We continued following the sheriff and his men for the remainder of the day. My eyes were burned with what I witnessed. I was numbed by grief. I felt myself weighed down by sorrow and aged beyond my years. I had never before seen such agony. I hated Mr. Adair, and I hated the fact that the law allowed him to cast aside so many of my people. I thought of the day that I had asked Mother if Mr. Adair was a Scotsman. I had wondered if he was a Scotsman, an Englishman, or if he was Irish. Now I knew that it didn't matter. He was a demon, and all that condoned his actions were in league with the devil. I wished him dead, and I did not feel a shred of remorse for having such thoughts. The evictions continued until the following day. Mrs. O'Donnell did not accompany us on the second day because she had not been given the day off. She filled our wagon with food and supplies before Sean and I left to follow the sheriff and his men. She insisted that we leave Sally with her because she knew that we would struggle to push the wagon and keep an eye on Sally. She knew that some of our neighbors that had taken to the road were already in dire need of food, blankets, and clothing. Sean and I helped anyone we encountered on the road. I noticed that we were not the only ones to do so. Even some of the sheriff's men gave money and food to the very people they had forcibly removed from their homes. Several of the sheriff's men had already left the Glen. I also noticed that Mr. Grierson had joined the sheriff's men. I had not noticed him on the previous day. Francis and his siblings joined us on that second day. We walked behind them. They had already used Pegasus to carry many of the very old, the very young, and the weak. These unfortunates were carried to neighboring estates where many had relations. On the second day, we had even been able to procure a small cart which was capable of holding 4 adults. Towards the end of the day, while we witnessed the destruction of the last of the cottages to be leveled, Francis and his siblings parted. Francis had agreed to take several of our neighbors to another estate that was at least a 3-hour walk from Derrivay. We knew that Mr. Adair would not be returning for another 2 days, so he would not notice that Pegasus was gone. I was still nervous. I knew that Francis's journey would likely take longer than anticipated. Pegasus was going to have to haul the cart with 4 adults and 3 children over rough terrain. He would need to rest before returning to Derrivay. I said a silent prayer that Mr. Adair did not return early as Sean and I watched the cart slowly move away. We walked around the side of Lauvay and made our way to the forest where we had once happily picked bilberries. We passed a depressed area that was used as a poor boat ramp to access the lake. As we did, we both heard a distinctive splash, followed by the sound of someone gasping for air. We exchanged looks. Aoife running at Francis. He could not have gone very far, Sean said. I ran as quickly as I could until I reached the road. I could see the cart slowly making its way down the road. I started to scream as loudly as I could. Francis immediately turned around. He dropped the reins and ran towards me. When he had almost reached me, I began to run back towards the lake. I could hear him behind me. We reached the lake at the same time. Sean had gone into the lake and was thrashing with someone. Francis jumped in and quickly grabbed the man that Sean had been trying to save. I reached for Sean's hand and started to pull him out of the lake. I almost dropped his hand from shock when I saw who Francis was clinging to. It was his father, Michael Bradley. I had a sick feeling that Michael Bradley had not accidentally fallen into the lake. I pushed aside these dark thoughts. I pulled Sean out of the lake and quickly wrapped him with my coat. I knew that his chest injury was permanent and any chill could kill him. I took Sean by the hand and pulled him further away from the lake. He stared in disbelief at Francis and Michael Bradley. I knew that he had the same suspicion that I had. "Come on, we need to get back to the house before you catch a chill," I said. Sean obeyed, and we quickly walked back to the house. We left our wagon near the lake. Once we made it to the house, Mrs. O'Donnell had Sean in dry clothes and in his bed in a matter of minutes. He was given the hot water bottles and extra blankets. He remained in bed for the remainder of the day. The following morning, Sean looked and sounded well. He accompanied me to our morning meal. We entered the kitchen and found that the dining table was crowded but eerily silent. Sean sat down and I joined Mrs. O'Donnell, who was still carrying food to the table. When we were both at the counter and far away from the table, she leaned close to me and whispered in my ear. "Michael Bradley has been taken to the hospital," she said. "Did he catch a chill falling in the lake?" I asked. She shook her head. After a moment's hesitation, she leaned close to me again. "He has been taken to the lunatic asylum in Letterkenny. He did not fall into the lake, love. He was trying to drown himself," she said. I inhaled deeply and stared at her with wide eyes. My suspicions had been confirmed. I felt sick again. She leaned closer to me. Do not speak of it, she said, motioning towards the table. I understood. Suicide was an unforgivable sin. I knew that I could not speak of it until Sean and I were alone. My heart ached for Francis and his father. Despite the tragedy that had occurred, Francis still took our neighbors to the neighboring estate. I hoped that he had enough time. I had not yet seen Pegasus return. I knew that Mr. Adair was in Letterkenny. I learned later that he had traveled to Letterkenny to meet with a newspaper man to speak of the evictions. He told the newspaper man, "What course was left to me? I would abandon these evictions with pleasure if the government could give me any assurance or guarantee for the safety of myself or my servants." We all knew this was a lie. Ridding himself of his tenants was done by design, and the misery he had inflicted on them was his pleasure. Mr. Grierson was involved in the evictions, and he remained at the estate after the evictions had taken place. Most of the sheriff's men were not local men, and none lived at the estate. Many resented Mr. Grierson, and Mr. Adair was quick to defend any of his actions. Mr. Grierson sometimes had a foul temper and had been known to shout at the tenants. He could also be very kind. Mrs. O'Donnell put it succinctly when she said, "He is a rough cut, Mr. Grierson." Mr. Adair took possession of Mr. Grierson as he had so many others. He also took possession of another at the same time. That was Francis. The fate of these two men converged due to the evil machinations of Mr. Adair. It was exactly 2 years after the evictions when the sheriff was called to our house again because Mr. Adair was claiming that some of his sheep had been stolen. We all knew that he was mistaken. We knew that Mr. Grierson might one day break Mr. Adair's neck, but he would never steal from him. We also knew that the remaining tenants hadn't stolen from him. When the sheriff arrived, it was clear that he did not relish the task. As soon as I saw him enter the house, I ran for Sean and returned to the house, dragging Sean behind me. By that time, I had involved Sean in all my eavesdropping escapades. He did not think that we should be eavesdropping on everyone, but he allowed me to drag him along each time. I suspected that he enjoyed clandestinely listening to the adults as much as I did, but he just didn't want to admit it. We had returned with Sally by the time the sheriff was entering Mr. Adair's study. I knew that Mr. Adair had been speaking with Mr. Grierson for the last hour. I had not listened to them because I found that most of their conversations were tiresome. Before Sean and I had even positioned ourselves, I heard the sheriff say something that set the tone for the rest of the conversation. "No, thank you, Mr. Adair. I would rather stand," he said. Sean and I exchanged looks. "This is not a social call," Sean said with a big grin. I put my hand over my mouth to stifle a laugh. "Very well, Sheriff," Mr. Adair said. "I am here because your man, Mr. the sheriff began." "Grierson, Mr. Grierson," Mr. Grierson said in a loud, booming voice. "Yes, Mr. Grierson called on me and told me that you are missing some of your sheep," the sheriff said. "Yes, just as before," Mr. Adair said. "If that is the case, then my investigation will be short," the sheriff said. "Explain yourself," Mr. Adair said, his voice growing hot. "When your sheep were stolen before, I discovered that the theft had been carried out by one of your Scots. You only have one left in service. Mr. Grierson, do you have anything to confess?" the sheriff asked in a sarcastic tone. Sean and I exchanged wide-eyed looks. I covered my mouth again. I heard a shuffle from inside the room. Are you accusing me of stealing, Sheriff? Mr. Gerson roared. I simply asked you if you had anything to confess. You and your kind have brought only trouble to this region. Theft and murder. This was a peaceful region until you, the sheriff shouted before he was silenced by the unmistakable sound of a struggle. How dare you, you bastard, the sheriff shouted. You son of a whore, Mr. Gerson said in a low, muffled voice. Mr. Adair, I will be taking your man with me to lockup, the sheriff shouted as he dragged Mr. Gerson out of the room. Mr. Adair did not answer. I ran from the door with Sean and Sally. We went to the kitchen and found Mrs. Barry baking. She saw us enter and mockingly glared at Sally. I suppose you want a treat, she said. I let go of Sally's leash and she ran to Mrs. Barry. Mrs. Barry always made a show of not approving of Sally, but she also never missed an opportunity to spoil her with treats and attention. Sean always grinned and gave a roll of his eyes behind Mrs. Barry's back. Mr. Gerson was just arrested by the sheriff, I said excitedly. Has he been stealing Mr. Adair's sheep? She asked. No, but he hit the sheriff, I said. Her eyes widened and she inhaled deeply. She put a small piece of meat in Sally's mouth and ushered us towards the table. I knew that we were to be rewarded for our gossip. It is difficult to feel pity for Mr. Gerson. He is, she began. A rough cut, I said, interrupting her. Sean and I both giggled. Mrs. Barry smiled and nodded. She brought us scones and tea. Mr. Adair will replace him soon enough. His job will probably go to Francis Bradley. I doubt we'll see Mr. Gerson around these parts again, she said. I am not sure if Francis wants to spend so much time with Mr. Adair, Sean said. None of us do, but he would probably accept the position. Mr. Adair has kept him busy with his flocks. He has even given some of his sheep to Francis, she said. I still don't think Francis will take the position, Sean said. There are some things you two don't know, she began. I knew what she was about to say, but I didn't want to interrupt her. She enjoyed her gossip and her opinions too much. Sean and I politely waited for her to finish. Mr. Adair has been caring for Francis's poor father, Michael Bradley, ever since that awful incident at the time of the evictions. He paid all of the hospital bills, and he even pays for a doctor to visit once per month, she said. I knew that to be true. Sean did not. His eyes widened. It is true. Once a month, Dr. Thorpe, I began before Mrs. Barry excitedly interrupted me. Dr. Henry Thorpe visits Francis's cottage and sees to his dear father. When he is done, he and Francis go to Mr. Adair and speak to him about Mr. Bradley's condition, she said. She sat down and reached for a scone. And a fine cottage they have since Mr. Adair has leaned more on Francis, she added. I knew that she was certainly right about that. Francis had been allowed to move his family into a much larger cottage on the estate. It was one of the largest ones. Why does Dr. Thorpe come here? Sean asked. Mr. Adair likes for Dr. Thorpe to report directly to him. Francis always accompanies Dr. Thorpe. I don't believe Dr. Thorpe enjoys his visits with Mr. Adair, she said. How is Francis's father? Will he recover? Sean asked. Mrs. Barry's face grew pensive. He has never fully recovered from his ordeal. He suffers from chronic chest ailments, and I believe he is starting to suffer from dropsy. Poor man, she said. She didn't say what we all knew to be true. Michael Bradley had never mentally recovered. His physical ailments were worsened by his troublesome mental state. The doctor is due in a few days, she said before getting up from the table.